closer.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I am your host for today's episode, and my name's Todd Conklin. Hope you're doing good. Hey, thanks for listening. It is always great to have you on board. I hope you're enjoying these. They're getting really interesting. Holy cow, today's going to be an interesting one, and I'm curious to see what you think about it, because I think you'll like it, but I don't know yet. Well, you'll have to listen to make sure. Hey, so what about the week? Well, let's see. This week, everything was grand, and I'm enjoying a little respite because I had a conference that I was supposed to speak at in South Africa that they had some financial difficulties and didn't end up wanting me to come over. So I'm not there. I'm here, which is great, and I'm enjoying being here, and that's even better, and I'm getting lots of crap done. And so that's good as well. Everything is grand. The numbers are amazing. Thank you for listening. Thanks for subscribing. Tell your friends. We're now at a point where I think we've got a really nice little community of thought going, and we can have really good discussions, and that's important as well. So I think you're going to love everything about this one. It is amazing. It is amazing, amazing, amazing. So we're going to talk to Tim Autry. And Tim works for an organization, actually he's the founder, I think, of an organization called Practicing Perfection International. Is that what it's called? It's PPI. He talks about it a bunch. A better podcast host would have probably looked this up before he cut the intro, but I'm not that guy. You're going to find Tim's conversation to be a bit different than the conversations I have with you, because Tim is a strong believer that you eliminate error from a system, whereas I'm a strong believer that error is non-eliminatable, if that's a word. I'm not sure if that's a word or not. And we don't really discuss it much, but we could have. I mean, the potential there was there all along to talk about it. Tim's great. He's super fun, and he's a great, super nice guy. And he's going to talk a lot about the way sort of he sees things happening in the world and the success his company's had, and I cannot deny that. I think he's out there making the world a better place, and I think that's really interesting. He's got a new book out. He'll pump that pretty well. By the time you hear this podcast, the book should be available, and it's called The 6-Hour Safety Culture. And he'll talk about it. He'll talk about how he can make a bold statement, because that, my friends, is a relatively bold statement to make. And I think that's worth listening to as well. Anything else? Hey, if you've got questions or comments, never hesitate to call me, because I'm always callable and I'm always incredibly interested in what you're thinking. Also, if you are really interested in the Foundations lecture series or whatever we're going to call that, I don't know what to call that, that's quite doable as well. Give me a yodel if you think that makes a difference. But until then, I think we're pretty much destined to have this conversation. Sit back and enjoy. I think you're going to find it interesting. I hope you find it challenging. Certainly that's the goal, is there are many ways to see the world, and we need to represent as many as we can, at least in the way we're thinking. So while I'm in your head in these headsets, I hope this is a challenging conversation and you listen to it and you come out of it stronger in what you believe, whatever it is you believe. I'm cool with it. It's all great with me, baby. It is all totally great with me. But I'm curious to see what you think. So without further ado, here is Tim Autry and our conversation.
I was going to say, you're doing a lot of traveling?
Yeah, I'm traveling a lot. I'm busy. It's slowing down a little bit, which is great for me, because I was just traveling too much, I think. I was gone all the time. But, you know, I'm just out there. I'm out there spreading the good word, you know, just pretty much the stuff I do. It's been really valuable, and everybody's getting better, and so that's good, and it's exciting, and it's good work. It's better than stealing.
Absolutely, it is. And there's, like you say, the good work, there's an idealistic side to it. And, you know, that's one of the things that I love about what we've been doing in PPI and the type of people that have been drawn to us to be our facilitators. We've never gone out and really gone after anybody. They've all come to us, and I think virtually every one of them, if not every single one of them, puts the idealistic part of what we do substantially ahead of the income earning part of what we do. And, you know, don't get me wrong, we all like money. But it's great to be able to make a living doing something where you know you're actually making the world a better place. And I know you feel the same way.
I do. I think that makes it kind of worth sitting in airports and, you know, waiting on delayed flights and canceled flights and then more delayed flights and more canceled. It kind of makes it all worthwhile. And it's exciting. I was just with some guys last week and the safety manager came in and said, "You know, my wife told me I haven't been this excited about work in 10 years.
And I said,
"That's nice, man. That's a good thing to say."
That's awesome. You know, for me, getting rewards or getting feedback like that, and that's the biggest reward there is. That makes everything worthwhile. Because, you know, in that situation, not only is that guy renewed his passion about his job, he's doing a better job. So the people he interfaces with at work are being more positively impacted. And beyond that, and perhaps even as important, if not more important than that, when he goes home, his home life's better because he comes home in a better mood. He's bringing positive energy home with him. And I think that's just awesome. You know, we had one of our success stories from the early days of PPI was a plant general manager who was introduced to what we do by one of the bargaining unit members of their facility. And after a year and a half or so, he finally agreed to do it because this guy just didn't let up. And as he tells the story, he said, "You know, even when we started, I really still didn't understand what it was. But," he said, "when I went through the leadership course," he said, "it totally changed the way I looked at everything." And he and I became pretty good friends. And when it came time for him to retire, Suzette and I flew down to go to his retirement party. And we're getting ready to leave the retirement party, and his wife pulls me aside as we're just getting ready to walk out the door. And she said, "You know, I got to tell you," she said, "you have no idea what a change your training made in my husband." She said, "I thank you. Our daughters thank you, and our grandchildren thank you." And it's like, you know what? It just doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's pretty special. So, yep. Tim, how'd you get started in all this? Give us your background.
I'll give you a little bit of the current story, and then I'll go to the backstory.
Sure, that's fine. That's fine.
You know, we've gotten to a point now in PPI where we literally have worked all over the world, and we've worked with tens of thousands of people. And so we've accumulated our own database of success and what has worked and what hasn't and all of this. And in addition to that, since I was probably 10 years old, I've been a student of human behavior. I started at the age of 10 reading Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, and then I went to How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. And then in my early 20s, as a broke sailor in San Diego, California, on one early Saturday morning, because I had no money to do anything else, I wandered into the library and found a Theory of Motivation by Abraham Maslow. And so the behavior side of this equation has always been an acute interest of mine. What I discovered when writing the book was, you know what, this whole human performance thing or human error reduction thing has been chasing after me since I really started in my adult life, which was starting in the Navy and then going into commercial nuclear power. And what I realized when I was writing the book, as I decided to finally sit down and write my story, was, you know what, there were four instances in my younger life when I should have been killed in all four instances, and I wasn't. And so, you know, I titled that section of the book, Three Strikes and You're Supposed to Be Out, because I actually made it through my fourth strike. And on the fourth strike, I finally got it and recognized that, you know, just a little bit of inattention, a little bit of assumption, that sort of thing, a little bit of increased pressure to get something done. So you bypass this, that, or the other thing, and son of a gun, in an instant, you can be dead. Or you can cause some really serious damage. As a matter of fact, my fourth strike occurred aboard the USS Ohio, which was a Trident nuclear missile submarine. And I was so fortunate because what I did by just doing something stupid, not thinking about it, I almost caused millions of dollars of damage to that submarine and would have actually influenced the mission of the boat. Because we were getting ready to go on patrol, and what I did could have damaged a very significant vital piece of safety equipment. And fortunately, it didn't really damage anything at all and nobody got hurt. So again, that was my fourth strike. And that's when I got it, because at that point, really thinking it through as to how in just one little slip of judgment and not paying attention and making an assumption, you can cause so much damage. And I almost, you know, I could have caused a Master Chief to get seriously hurt or killed by what I did as well. And, you know, the whole story's in the book. But anyway, that was kind of my real defining moment. And then moving forward, as I ended up in the commercial nuclear power world, you know, in the early 90s, that industry started pumping tons of money and energy into the reduction of human error. And because of my interest in human behavior and human performance, I just ended up in these positions that got involved in that whole effort all the way through. And that kind of came to a head in 2003 through 2005, when I was at the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant, and senior leadership gave me the opportunity to conduct an experiment at that facility approaching human performance, which, you know, in nuclear power, human performance basically means human error reduction.
Right.
But approaching it my way. And they didn't micromanage me. I was a department head at the time, so I had some, you know, they budgeted money for it. And in the next 30 months, we took an average performing plant and we reduced the incidence of human error by 87.5%. And the results were so outstanding that INPO took notice. I got a big promotion and got stock options from the company.
Nice.
Other nuclear plants were inviting me to come around and speak, like, you know, a lot of the invitations you're getting, which was pretty cool. And in February of 2005, the plant had been purchased by one of these large companies that has a fleet of nuclear plants.
Gotcha.
And they brought in a new plant manager whose mission it was to make our plant look like every other plant in the fleet, which none of us appreciated, of course, but that's natural human nature. Nobody appreciates being forced to do anything. However, this guy came in, and after all the successes we'd had, and that was only one of my areas of responsibility, one of about six areas, and in every single area that I had been responsible for, the folks in my department had just made amazing progress. And that was basically because I helped the systems, and I got out of their way, and I encouraged them and everything. They did it, you know. I just had the opportunity to work with these great people. But success, 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 success. Anyway, this guy comes in, and his marching orders are to make our plant look like all the other plants in the fleet. And I had been traveling out of town, and he said a couple of things about me to my boss, which my boss related to me. And I was so, for lack of a better phrase, pissed off by what he said. It's like, this moron doesn't even recognize what has happened here, you know, over the past 2 years. And I turned in my resignation the next day and started PPI, and that was 10 years ago. So,
wow,
that's you know, a longer answer than you probably wanted to your story, but no, that's how good. It all kind of came together.
That's good. So what do you think? Because I'm always really curious about this idea of managing error, and we sort of come to this from different directions. You know, I think error is pretty inevitable. In fact, I think error is kind of it's so inevitable it's kind of boring. It's kind of opportunistic. But right. You guys really see it as something to be corralled and managed, right?
Well, we see it as something to be minimized. I mean, anybody that's been involved in this field for any period of time recognizes one of the cardinal things, which we repeat over and over and over and over and over when we're working with clients. Human beings are fallible. We make mistakes. As a matter of fact, I make more mistakes than anybody I know, which is, I think, why I ended up in this business in the first place. So really, in what we like to say is, what you want to do is you want to initiate efforts to drive the incidence of human error to the lowest possible levels of frequency and severity, knowing you're never going to eliminate it. But when you do that properly and you achieve a synergy of people working together in their teams and things, we believe that events, you know, which are things that rise to a certain level of significance, somebody getting seriously hurt or killed or significant environmental catastrophe or damaging, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars worth of equipment, we believe when you put the pieces together properly, events can be prevented. you're never going to prevent errors. I mean, I don't know if you know, his name is right off the,
So I probably know him if his name is nothing, I know him.
Yeah, you know his name right off the top of my head. As a matter of fact,
it escaped me.
His actual first name is Tim, just like mine, but he doesn't use Tim. He uses, is it Shane?
Oh, yeah. Timothy Shane Bush. Yeah, he's been on the podcast.
Shane Bush, yeah.
He's been on the podcast.
Yeah. Well, you know, I love the way he puts it. He says, you know, if you're going to try to eliminate errors, you're going to go broke and you're going to go insane. And I love the way he puts that. I think that's pretty brilliant. And it's absolutely true. So it's not about eliminating errors. It's about minimizing them. And then when you look at, you know, as well as I do, when you do the only time we really do a cause analysis or a root cause analysis, the more significant stuff, and generally, particularly for any real significant thing, there are all kinds of opportunities along the way where if that hole had been plugged, it wouldn't have happened, yada, yada, yada. So, you know, our thought process is when you get people thinking right and you get them a sense of, and we're talking, so let's take an organization now, you get workers at all levels. And when I say workers, for goodness sakes, I'm not just talking about the front line. And that's a mistake oftentimes we see companies make when you talk about workers. They only think of the people at the front line. Now, I don't know if that's because they think the people at higher levels don't do any work. But anyway, hopefully that's not the case. So you take the members of an organizational team from the top to the bottom, and when you get them thinking right and you expand their context and you implement the approach that we have been using, and it's, of course, our approach is not exclusive, but the elements of it that where you treat people like people and you allow, for example, one of our precepts is, well, two precepts that really fit together well, you know, and there's only four of them. One of them is people come to work wanting to do a good job, which right. I absolutely believe 100%.
Right. Gotcha.
And the fourth one is the people who do the work are the ones that have the answers.
Right. Gotcha.
So, now, precept number two is 84 to 94% of all human error can be directly attributed to process, programmatic, or organizational issues. And really what that means, that's a long way of saying, the lion's share of times somebody screws up at work, it's not just blatant making a really poor assumption or not paying attention. There are almost always, the majority of the time, contributing factors. Poor labeling, poor libeling, or poor lighting, undue stress, vague procedure wording where they're forced to interpret on the fly, you know, all those different kinds of things that we're all familiar with. But, you know, the one of the things that we teach big time is, and we call it the next level approach. And I know there's some other terms out there like new view and things like that. And that's our phraseology is next level. And if you want to take your performance to the next level, you got to think different. And we love playing off of, you know, Apple's campaign from 20 years ago, think different, because right. of the being grammatically incorrect, it gets your attention. But thinking different's not enough. You got to do different.
Does your approach take away from creating error tolerance? Because you were talking about reliability, high reliability, and error behavior. What do you guys think about creating error tolerant systems? Systems where you know the error is going to happen, but the error has less consequence or no consequence.
Well, yeah, we teach that, and I'll tell you, we when you get to the measurement side of it, which virtually everybody wants to do, you want to measure your progress. Well, there's a threshold below which you don't count it. It's and I think that relates directly to what your question is. It's you're tolerant of that. Now, if there's an opportunity to learn, you certainly want to learn from that, because the little things oftentimes. You got lucky and nothing really happened, and it was a small little thing. You know, I like to use the example of when I'm teaching to a live venue. You know, I'll use an example like, okay, this table leg here. So I'm up here prattling on, carrying on like I love to do, and I trip over that table leg. Well, that was an error, right? But there was absolutely no consequence. And those kind of things happen all the time. On the other hand, I could trip over that table leg, and because there's very thin carpet over a concrete floor in this room, I could trip down, my right kneecap could smash down into that concrete, shatter my kneecap, and I said, now we've got something significant. The important thing to understand about that, of course, is the initiating act was exactly the same. But I think, you know, I think that's a great, great lesson to put out there, because you've got to – resources are limited. The value of what you can learn out of certain things is limited. Sometimes, for example, tripping over that table leg. Well, you know, we don't necessarily need to write a condition report on that and do an investigation and have corrective actions. How about if we just, you know, put a little orange cone right there or what have you, and get people thinking like that on the spot? So that's kind of how we've been approaching it. And I think, you know, having come from nuclear land, and another one of my areas of responsibility in my last job was we had the corrective action program as well. And you want to talk about expending exorbitant amount of resources for very little return on investment. And that's one of the ways where you can really cut that down is when you have that tolerance, you establish that threshold. And so if it crosses over this threshold of, let's say it goes beyond a first aid case, or maybe it even becomes a first aid case, or and I think organizations have to decide this for themselves, or it, you know, X amount of dollars worth of equipment damage or yada, 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 then we approach it as something a little more significant.
Well, I'm kind of thinking of this this train crash that happened in Philadelphia, the Amtrak train. It looks like it's still pretty early, but it looks like the engineer was really interested in rail safety, blogged about it, posted it on his Facebook, strong proponent of rail safety systems. And yet this engineer, who is by all accounts, at least early on in this equation, very much the ideal human performance employee, really thoughtful, thought about errors, wrote about it, researched it, really into it, this failure still happened. And the question I would ask is, was the error inevitable and should we manage the consequence, or do we want to manage the behavior and try to remove the error? And I think it's a really interesting question.
It is a very interesting question. And I think, you know, in our field, it's probably one of the gazillion dollar questions. And just like in almost anything in life, I think you're going to need to find the right balance. And I haven't investigated the specific incident that you're talking about. You really have to look into all of the known data, in my opinion.
Right. And we don't have any of that yet. I mean, it's still pretty early. But it's, you know, I've been watching Bob from the NTSB get up and give the presentations. And of course, I'm like you, I look into those kind of failures pretty deeply because I'm interested in those failures. Do you think error is a choice?
Well, again, I think sometimes in retrospect, it was a choice.
Well, I think to be fair, Tim, in retrospect, everything's a choice. But retrospect,
yeah, you're right.
But in context, do you think error is a choice? Because I think that's a really, to me, that's an important delineator in whether you can remove error or not remove error. If you think error is a choice, then simply asking people to choose to not make those errors would make the world a better place. If you don't think error is a choice, then you're kind of in a different position. What do you think?
Well, I think I would like to relate this to the concept of violation.
I didn't ask that question. I'll ask that next. But okay. Is error a choice?
Well, I can really only answer that, I think, from my perspective.
Well, that's what I want, Tim. I want your perspective.
No, but I mean about me personally.
Well,
I cannot imagine a situation where I would choose on purpose to make an error.
Right.
Because if you come back again, and this is in PPI world, but our precept number three is people come to work wanting to do a good job. I have yet to meet a person that came to work wanting to screw up. Now, you do have, you know, what are called C players that want to get away with whatever they can and do as little work as they can. But even those folks, they don't want to get hurt. Well, unless they want to get disability or something.
Right,
of course, those are few and far between.
Yeah, let's not talk about sociopaths. We can remove them out of the system.
Right. So
normal people.
I do not think error is a choice. I guess in the overview, if I'm using myself as an example, which I'm the only human being that I can really claim to know even partially well, I would not consciously choose to make an error. So now, if you want to give me a different example or a scenario,
we could do a million scenarios, but it's interesting, and this is just something I'm thinking about: is if we see error as a choice, then our solution is always going to be to ask workers to make better choices, which is not a bad conversation. It's probably a really good conversation to have. If we see error as something other than a choice, an error, right?
Right.
Then we tend to create solutions where we look at ways to make it difficult to make that error, or when that error happens, right, it has less consequence, that kind of thing.
Right. And you know, I think the ultimate answer is you want to do both. And you get into the human factor sides of things, and you get into Poka-Yoke in the world of lean, and all those things are designed to minimize the risk of a human being screwing up. But then when we come back to the concept of choice, there's a phenomenal opportunity there. And, you know, quite honestly, that is exactly where we focus in the world of practicing perfection, is the choices you make dictate the life that you lead. And that's on a moment-by-moment basis. And when we get back to the question, does somebody choose to make an error? You know, one of the things I love about Sidney Decker's work is he was one of the first people to come out and say, you know what, you got to put yourself in to the best of your ability in the mind of the individual under those conditions at that moment in time to understand why they made the choice that they did. And there's so many variables around that. So if you come right down to it, at that moment when that person made that choice under those conditions at that moment in time, were they choosing a consequence that would be less than desirable? I would say no.
And that local rationale thinking, which has really changed, well, it's completely changed our world for sure, but it's changed the way we do investigations. It's changed the way we think about understanding failure at every level. That's been super, super helpful, but it puts us in a position where we think, okay, what's next? And that is my question to you. What do you think the future is? What's next? What are you guys at PPI thinking about next?
Okay, well, I'll tell you, I've been doing some really fun learning about the physiology and the chemistry of the human mind and the brain and how it impacts your hormones and how it impacts your overall attitude, which of course affects your choices. So that's kind of where we're getting going further and further down the rabbit hole in that, as far as how to approach people to help modify their behaviors on a grand context. Our primary focus is really about helping people, number one, expand their context about what is possible. And the example that I love to use for this is when I'm talking to a room full of safety people, I say, for example, go back 20 years ago. And if I would have told you 20 years ago that you were going to achieve the kind of safety numbers or OSHA recordable rates that you have today, what would you have told me? You would have told me it's absolutely impossible. And yet little by little, and in that particular case, I think we can thank government regulation and perhaps even coercion in some cases, forcing it to the priority level of the decision makers and those who are, you know, and our workplaces today are way safer than they were 20 or 30 years ago. It's a completely different environment, right? And the numbers are consequently completely different. Okay, now, forecast yourself 20, 30 years into the future. What can the numbers possibly be? Because on a scale of, you have to be able to believe something's impossible or something is possible in order to actually take actions to move in that direction. Now, it doesn't mean you're going to achieve it overnight or anything like that, but to move in that direction. So anyway, what we do, which has been so phenomenally, I mean, it just continues to blow my mind how powerful this is by expanding people's context about what is possible for them and the fact that they really can make a difference, you know, because I honestly believe it's an intrinsic aspect of human nature that we want to matter. We want to make a difference. And most organizations have done a phenomenal job of ripping that away from people, of robbing them of that opportunity. You know, if you go back to the Eighth Habit written by Stephen Covey, for example, which is not that recent now, but one of the things that he talked about in there was what's called the whole person approach. And when you treat people like people instead of like things, you begin to open up a world possibility that didn't exist before. You know, a great example of this is some of those movies we've seen, like Freedom Riders and Stand By Me, and some of those great movies where teachers have gone into inner city schools that are completely dysfunctional, and these kids are in gangs, and their brothers and mothers and fathers are getting shot, and they're in prison and all this kind of stuff. And turning a classroom of those types of kids around into human beings who actually value their lives, want to do something with their lives. And if you remember the story about Jaime Escalante and the calculus tests, you know, for these kids to get into college, and they accused him of cheating. Do you remember that movie?
Yeah.
So if a teacher can go in and make such dramatic changes in such a dysfunctional environment, what can just a little bit of tweaking do with a group of workers who have come to work wanting to do a good job? They've got all kinds of insight and intelligence and creative make things better energy. That, because they've been managed like things, has been – that opportunity has either been denied them, or the organizational structure has done the best job it possibly could to stomp it out of them. What happens when you open that up vertically and horizontally and allow all that stuff to begin to work together? And that's exactly what the practicing perfection approach does. So coming back to that concept of choice, you know, one of the examples that I like to use, you know, the, and I'm sure you're aware of this, the linchpin, as far as we're concerned, in organizational performance is the frontline supervisor, because that individual has by far the most impact on how work actually gets done on a day-to-day basis. So you take two frontline supervisors, one of which, you know, has run a team or a crew or whatever that has the reputation of the get her done team or the get her done crew, and you want something done on schedule or ahead of schedule, by golly, you give it to them because they're going to figure out how to get it done. And so on Monday, the supervisor brings old Bob in, who did a job on Friday, and Bob was did a job that was supposed to take 3.5 hours, and he got it done in 2 hours and 15 minutes. And the supervisor, you know, parades Bob up in front of the team on Monday morning saying, "Bob, awesome job, man. You got that 3.5 hour job done in 2 hours and 15 minutes. Well, everybody on the team knows that the only way you can get that 3.5 hour job done in 2 hours and 15 minutes is by cutting corners, by cutting procedural corners, by often cutting safety corners and that sort of thing. So even though what the supervisor is directly recognizing and rewarding is time shaved off the schedule and fewer man hours, he's also rewarding cutting corners, because everybody knows that's how you get that kind of recognition. Now compare that supervisor to supervisor B over here, or Bravo, who says all the time, "Look, I don't care what the job is. I don't care where we are on the schedule. Nothing, absolutely nothing, is worth you putting yourself in harm's way, taking corners, you know, that could possibly cause you to get hurt. Nothing's worth that, you know. Our number one thing is we all want to go home in the same or better condition we were in when we came to work every day. And if it's going to take you a little bit longer to get that job done, to do it safely, I've got your back." And that supervisor supports that individual or the members of that team consistently that way all the time. So you got to ask yourself, are the choices and behaviors from crew A, the folks on crew A, going to be different on a day-to-day basis than the choices and behaviors on crew B? Now, of course, it will vary a little bit by individual personality and all that sort of thing. But generically speaking, the folks on crew A, the get-her-done crew, they're going to be much more willing and likely to make those choices that we're talking about at the moment that could be more error likely. They're not intending to make an error. So I wouldn't say they're choosing to make an error, but they're making more error likely choices because they've been taught that's what it means to do a good job. Whereas the folks over here on Crew Bravo, you know, they know if it's going to take longer to do it safely, that is the core principle of the thing. That is the number one thing. And so that's how we're going to conduct ourselves over here. So I think that's a real long-winded answer of getting back to answering your question. If you combine on the global level, people come to work wanting to do a good job. Moment by moment, they're going to make those choices. And so that's at an instant. But you can say there are hundreds and thousands of choices being made every moment in an operating organization, and that's where those choices get influenced. And that comes predominantly from the frontline supervisor, but the overall organization as well has – you know, it's like the culture. If you talk about culture, and I don't know if you want to go down this path or not, but this is one of my pet things, because we still have experts out there saying changing the culture is hard and it takes a long time. And based upon our 10 years of experience, I absolutely disagree with that, which is one of the reasons why I titled my book the way I did, 6-Hour Safety Culture. I figured it's going to get people's attention. That's the reason for the title of the book.
Sure.
And there's a basis for it. I'm not going to bore you with the details of that unless you want to know. But that's the reason we called it that. But, you know, the culture in which we live influences the way that we think, whether it's the country in which we live, the community in which we are, the church group that we happen to belong to, the organization that we're part of, all the way down to our natural work team. We're influenced by that culture. Likewise, we have the opportunity to influence that culture. And so getting back to the whole choice thing, I think those choices are influenced. And if we're going to target the next thing, what's the next thing? What's taking things to the next level? It's influencing people internally, helping them change their context, their sense of ownership, so that day in and day out when they're making those choices, they're making better, safer, more holistic choices. And those are more in concert with a clearer understanding of what the concept of doing a good job really means. So there's a lot of dynamics involved there, but that's
I'll shut up now.
So
what a great talk we had. Did we get enough? Did we cover enough?
Well, I think so.
I think it was brilliant, man. I think you sounded amazing.
Well, thank you. And I always love listening to you talk. And one of the things I love about your style is you're not afraid to call it like you see it. And I've always been the same way. I like to think of myself as a rebel in this world of, so many people thinking they know they have the answers, and they're all the same answers. And if that's true, then why aren't things getting better at a more rapid rate?
That's right.
And so we're all always looking for ways to poke holes and learn new things and get better. And, we call it constant, never-ending improvement in our world. And, one more thing I did want to say. I'll kind of cap that whole thing off and then
sure.
See if you just have any closing comments. This whole thing about culture, there are two predominant schools of thought, and this directly relates back to your question about do people choose to make errors. One predominant school of the thought is it's got to come from the top down. You've got to have exceptional vision, and you've got to have charismatic leaders, and you've got to have constant energy pumped into it from the top. The other predominant school is you got to grow it organically from the bottom and rely upon things such as viral growth and things like that. And there are different approaches to both of those. Now, our philosophy is you need both, but the real answer is, which is how you can do it in 6 hours, by the way, at the natural work team level, the real answer is culture change comes from the inside out. And that's how you want to target, because that's where people are making choices on a moment-by-moment basis as to whether to be safer, more reliable, or whether to cut corners because – maybe there's more emphasis, or maybe I get rewarded for being faster instead of safer, those kinds of things.
Right.
So anyway, I'll just cap off with that. And then, I do want to say, since I have this opportunity to put a plug in there.
Yeah, go.
The book will be out June 1st, and you can go to 6hoursafetyculture.com and get all kinds of details about it. It'll be on Amazon.com and everywhere else that books get sold. And we're excited about that. Well, thanks, Todd. And
you're welcome, my friend.
You want to do this again sometime in the future? I would love to.
That's Tim Autry and Practicing Perfection Institute. I think I got it right this time. What'd you think? I'm so curious to talk to you about this one because it was so interesting. There are parts of this that I think are absolutely brilliant. No question about it. And there are parts of this that I think are a bit old school, and the mixture is really interesting to me. Maybe that's a good way to say it. I hope I didn't mess him up by asking him that choice question. But I think it has to be asked, and I think it's a really important question to ask because it represents a couple different frames of thought, and it really is that transition between the current view and the new view, that safety differently view. And, I'll make no secret about it. I believe that behavior is not the only tool you have to manage safety. And that his statistics, and Tim's got a lot of the statistics, I think his statistics support my view. But we'll see. Either way, it was a remarkable podcast, and I know it's a valuable one for you to listen to. I promise you that much, that's for sure. I hope you enjoyed it immensely. It's always so much fun to spend time with you. And this one is thought-provoking, no question about it. Hey, have a great day. Learn something new every single day. And for goodness sakes, be safe. I'll talk to you next time. I promise you that much. See you then.